This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. As the opioid epidemic continues devastating lives throughout our region, now health officials are reporting a spike in second wave epidemics like hepatitis C. As Kara Lofton reports, one way to combat the epidemic may be more needle exchange programs.
Jeff Chris stands at the entrance of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department Needle Exchange, waiting to gently waylay participants as they walk in.
So we're doing rampant Hep C and HIV testing today. It takes about 20 minutes. Would you like to go ahead and get that taken care of while you're here?
Not today.
No? Okay. I can give you my number, and you can call me, and we can set up something, just me and you, if you want to.
Most people say no, or that they already have been tested and are positive, before heading down the hall.
There's on average between 225 and 250 people that come through every Wednesday. Whenever I'm here testing, and I'm not here every week, but whenever I'm here testing, I average about 25 tests. And of those, more than half are positive.
West Virginia HealthRight, a free clinic, has been partnering with the county health department for about half a year to provide rapid hepatitis C testing.
The other thing about hepatitis C is that it's now the number one infectious killer in the United States. More people die from hepatitis C than any other infectious cause in the United States.
That's Dr. Michael Brummage, executive director of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department. Untreated hepatitis C can cause scar tissue to form in the liver, causing serious damage, jaundice, and cancer. From 2010 to 2015, cases of acute hepatitis C infection increased roughly threefold nationally, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, with the biggest increases occurring among young white persons living in rural areas, particularly Appalachia. West Virginia's 2015 rates were more than four times the national average. The CDC attributes the spike to IV drug use.
I was an IV user for 10 years. And I contracted it through using needles and sharing needles with other people.
Lindsay Hawkins is in her late 20s and a mother of four.
You know for a fact if you're going to use needles to get high, then 98% chance you're going to have hepatitis or you're going to catch HIV. Like,
so you were aware of that when you were using?
Yeah, but there was no needle exchange.
Hawkins is from Fayette County, and the needle exchange in Charleston opened after she had already entered rehab. She says if there had been one, though, she definitely would have used it.
Like, because when you're on the street, it's really hard to find needles. So you have to keep reusing needles and using one needle to fix another needle to make a good needle. It's insanity when you look back at it.
Brummage from the Kanawha Charleston Health Department says needle exchanges make a big difference in preventing the spread of disease.
We know that syringe exchange programs are very effective to reduce the spread of hepatitis C. We're also working with a pharmaceutical company who has a grant program that will allow us to test for hepatitis B, C, and HIV, and we're hoping to get that grant so that we can do this on a larger scale than what we're currently doing it.
How are you this morning? All right. So you are new today? All right. And it looks like you're picking up for someone else as well?
Sarah Embry is a pharmacist at the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy. She says her job is to not only help facilitate the needle exchange, but to help educate people on how it's contracted.
We had a patient a few weeks ago that didn't really understand how hepatitis and HIV was transmitted. He thought it was something almost like chicken pox, that it would reactivate within himself. And so he was concerned that he was going to give himself hepatitis. And so we tried to explain to him that that's not really possible. It's only from sharing with other people who are already infected. I think that's what's the most difficult thing is making sure that patients know the ways that they can get infected and the things that they need to look out for in other people.
Embry says for a lot of the patients she talks to, hepatitis C isn't that big of a deal. That may be because most clinics won't treat patients for hepatitis C unless they have stopped using IV drugs for 6 months or more. The good news is if they do stop using, hepatitis C isn't a death sentence anymore. The bad, the drugs to treat hepatitis are incredibly expensive and the cost can be prohibitive, although there are some clinics who offer drugs for free. As for Lindsay Hawkins, the mother of four, she caught a break. While in rehab, she retested, and as is the case with about a quarter of those studied, found out her hepatitis had gone into spontaneous remission. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, with support from the Benedim Foundation, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:49. Some areas of fog lingering, mostly sunny skies today with highs in the 80s, clear overnight with lows in the 50s and 60s, mostly sunny Thursday with highs in the 80s, mostly clear Thursday night with lows in the 60s, and mostly sunny on Friday, a slight chance of rain and thunderstorms with highs in the 80s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents available at erieinsurance.com. In the next part of our occasional series on the timber and forest products industry in West Virginia, today we find out how timber cruisers help landowners decide when to harvest trees, which trees to take, and which ones to leave behind. Producer Gene Snitiger joins Kelly Riddle of Allegheny Wood Products at a privately owned forest near Kingwood in Preston County.
One of the interesting things about being a forester is that not every stand or site is the same. You know, you walk to the other side of a hollow or the other side of the ridge, the site conditions change, the species change, the understory changes, and so it's kind of a new canvas any place that you walk.
How do you guys decide what you're going to take?
It depends on several factors. One that we look at is, first of all, if we're dealing with a private landowner, what their goals and objectives are. Second, we look at merchantability of the trees. And what I mean by that is it usable for a commercial process, whether it be for saw timber or pulpwood or some other product. And then we look at the overall health of the stand and the trees. This stand is composed primarily of yellow poplar and soft maple, with some scattered oaks in here. I looked at the size of the trees as an indication of whether they've reached their either biological maturity or financial maturity. Generally, once a tree reaches about 18 inches in diameter, and this depends on the site it's growing on and other factors, it's probably reached its financial maturity, meaning if you harvested that tree, gained the revenue from that tree, reinvested that in something else, you could do better on a financial standpoint than if you left that tree grow. Biologically, the tree may have 50 more years that it could live and produce wood and other values. The other thing that we're trying to do is create optimum growing space for the residual trees that you have. This tree happens to be a yellow poplar. This tree is 24 inches in diameter, and given the age and condition of the stand, I marked this tree because it's mature, it's ready to be harvested, and as you can see, there are other trees adjacent, this hard maple, for instance, that is one of the trees that I want to be the next stand. So by taking this out, it creates product for our sawmill, and it also creates space for that maple to grow and be part of the next stand.
How often do you go back to a stand, and how do you decide how often you go back?
We go back to a stand about every 5 years to reevaluate the growth and the response that we've had since the last thinning, let's say. We typically look at a 12 to 15 year cycle of reentry. In these stands where they're pretty much even aged, they were all regenerated about the same time, you can do that three or four times depending on the stands, the site, and the characteristics of how good a site it is. And then towards the end of that 80 to 100-year period, you have to look at regeneration and maybe in the form of shelter wood-type harvests and get a more uneven-aged management distribution.
What do you mean by a shelter wood-type harvest?
It's a little more intensive harvest where you have fewer trees per acre that are remaining. It allows full sunlight to reach the forest floor, which most of our species here in Appalachia need in order to regenerate. All of our poplar, cherry, all of our oaks are shade intolerant, and they will not regenerate without that full sunlight. So it's a requirement to start, initiate the next stand.
As we walk through the forest, Kelly Riddle points out the various types of marks he's put on the trees. These marks tell the loggers which trees to cut and whether they should go to the sawmill nearby or the pulp mill in Luke, Maryland.
Foresters have their own signature way of marking. If I have a tree that's primarily a sawtimber tree, I'll just put a dot, whereas a lateral slash may mean that there's some imperfection in that tree, or it's a pulpwood or a cull type tree. A full cull tree would be an X.
What about bad management? People that don't manage their timberlands very well, in your opinion?
I think that there are some misconceptions about what is bad management. Sometimes you have something that doesn't look aesthetically pleasing, and people might consider that to be bad management. As foresters, we know that's not necessarily the case. There are some fairly intensive harvests where most of the material is removed that can be very good management. It's not aesthetically pleasing. As a forester now for over 30 years, the worst thing that I think we can do is high grade our stands. And that is a management technique. It's not even a management. It'd be a harvest philosophy where all you took was the best and left only the low grade, non-commercial species, something like these soft maples that are damaged or have issues already. And all you were taking was the cream, so to speak, those best. If you do that more than one, say, thinning cycle, then you've left the stand. It has trees, it might look fine, but from a commercial standpoint, it has no value to the landowner. We do have a really great resource in West Virginia as a whole, not just here in Preston County, but all over West Virginia. We have a terrific hardwood resource. We say that we're trying to provide a resource for today and manage it for future generations.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jean Snediger in Preston County.
This series is made possible with funding from the Miles Family Foundation. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, Marshall University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. I'm Teresa Wills.